From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Dang, it's been nice out the last few days, and it's going to look nicer coming up to the weekend. Great time to get out, do some hiking in the outdoors, but you want to make sure you get back okay. You need to bring things for your safety, things like water, matches, and a map, even if you think it's only going to be a short trip. Lee Callahan is a radio DJ in Seattle, and she probably can't remember every item on the list, but she can tell you exactly when she learned about them. It was a hike she took up Mount Si with her friend Claire in the summer of 1985.
Being young and fit and feeling invulnerable, we decide we're going to take off in just our short shorts, our sneakers, our little socks, and our little tank tops, period. So up we go. And it is straight up. It's about 3 miles up Mount Si. We get to the top and we say, oh, what the view is incredible. Off in the distance, you can see Bellevue and maybe Seattle in the hazy, in the sun. And it's actually the sunset. And I think, Claire, the sun is setting. We need to get off of this hill. We need to go. So we take off. And the light's going down and down. As soon as we get into the tree, it's getting black out. We can't see a thing. But I say to Claire, I feel like I can see the trail. So let's just keep going. So she's hanging on to the back of my shirt, and down the trail we go. But then we cross over water. I don't remember water at all. But then I really don't remember anything about coming up except that it was pretty and we were fit and young. So at this point of water, I think we need to take a left. I think we're off. And so we take a left onto, for some reason, a fallen log. And we decide that this is a good idea to get onto a fallen log and to start sort of straddling it. Maybe this is going to get us somewhere. I don't know where. And then there's another fallen log. And I'm like, come on, let's go onto this one. And then we kind of decide to sit for a second, Claire and I, onto the second fallen log. And I'm thinking, we are lost. Claire's saying, we got to keep going. We shouldn't stay overnight here. So she gets up and she starts to look around a bit. And in this looking around, Claire slips. She slips and she falls down off of the log, and I hear, and she has landed below. And it might be 5 feet, it might be 10 feet, and I hear, and I'm like, Claire, come on. And I pull her back up, get her back onto the log, and I'm like, Claire, what are we gonna do? She goes, well, when I have gotten into situations where I'm lost, I pray to St. Anthony. And I go, oh, is this some Catholic thing? She goes, yeah, yeah. I go, well, how's it go? St. Anthony, St. Anthony, please come around. There's something lost and it needs to be found. And I say, well, how about this? St. Anthony, St. Anthony, please come around. There's two people lost and they better be found. She goes, yeah, that'll work. And then it turns into St. Anthony, St. Anthony, please come around. There's two people lost and they better be found. Hello? Hello? And we hear voices up above us. Hello? Hello, hello, we're down here. Where are you? We're up here. So I grab Claire and we start to head up, crawling up, and I'm kind of pulling Claire, who's very tired, and get up to the top of the trail. And I swear to God, our chins are at the top of the trail where their feet are. And they pull us up, this couple. It's a man and a woman and a dog. And they pull us up. And I said, you must have taken off after us. I said, well, how can you see anything? She goes, we've got Puzzle. You've got Puzzle. She's our little dog, and there's little Puzzle. And we're just following the tip of Puzzle's tail, the little white tip, down the mountain. She can sniff out the trail, and we're just following her down the mountain. So we get up, and we all start to go. And on the rest of the way down the mountain with these two wonderful people, so we get in our car. We start driving back to town, and Claire says, oh, man, I got to pull over and call Doug, her husband. But I don't want to call him because he's going to be so mad we didn't have the 10 essentials. I'm like, the 10 essentials? So on the way home, Claire explains the 10 essentials. And they're like matches and coats and water and bedding, I'm sure. I don't know what the 10 essentials are. Years later, my dad, he's a hiker. So one of his hikes that he's going to do, his practice hikes, is Mount Si. And he says, hey, Lee, you want to go up? I'm like, yeah. But we're bringing 10 essentials And we're going very early in the morning.
Lee Callahan, DJ for KZOK in Seattle. Thanks to Puzzle the Dog, Lee made it off Mount Si okay. But every year, search and rescue teams across the U.S. have to go to the aid of lost and injured people in our parks. According to the National Park Service, more than 100 people have been rescued from Mount Rainier National Park in the last 3 years alone. So how can outdoor adventurers stay prepared and avoid the emergencies? Last January, I talked to Jason Knight. He's co-founder of the Alderleaf Wilderness College in Monroe, Washington. Listeners also called in with their questions on how to survive in the wilderness. We first talked about those essential items Lee Callahan didn't have on that trip up Mount Si.
Your must-haves are shelters, your first concern. You want to have really good clothing, dress in layers, bring extra. It always gets colder than you expect it to be, especially if you're going up in elevation or if you have to spend the night, it's going to get colder. So bring extra layers, good rain gear. A rain can show up at any time unexpectedly, especially in the mountains. You want to bring some way to make fire, multiple ways of making fire. So I always recommend bring a lighter, a backup lighter, bring a flint and steel because there's some conditions where your lighter might not work. You always want to bring water, so enough water for how much time you spend to be out there, and then extra or a filter in case you have to spend more time than you expect to be out there. And it's always good to bring a little bit of extra food. You know, bring a Cliff Bar or something like that that you can munch on. It'll give you some extra calories. I always tell folks that even if you have a great GPS, bring along a map and compass. Study the maps ahead of time. Tell someone where you're planning on going and when you're planning on coming out.
Now, there's having a map. And there's knowing how to use a map. I mean,
correct.
There's a big difference there, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes. I think everybody should learn how to read a topographic map. You know, the USGS topo maps are best because they show you terrain and water and roads and trails. And it's one of the best maps you can have out there.
Now, if I'm going backpacking somewhere on the Olympic Peninsula, somewhere I'm out in the wilderness, what are my absolute necessary tools? What's my must-have? Is there a good knife to have with you if you're going out?
Yeah, you know, for wilderness survival situations, I always recommend a small fixed blade, something 3 or 4 inches long that's really durable because it'll handle all the tasks you might need it to do for in a survival situation, whether it's splitting wood or making a shelter. You know, the multi-tools are can be good as well for different tasks, but a good sturdy fixed blade is what I recommend everyone carries with them in the wilderness.
Of course, part of the reason to go out in the wilderness is to see wild critters, but sometimes that can be a little nerve-wracking. We've got Patrick on the line, and Patrick is giving us a call from the University District. Patrick, what's your question?
My question is about how to face off with a grizzly if you come in contact with one. You know, in the past, it was something to the effect of lay down and play dead, but recently, with research that was done up in Alaska and such, it was to stand up, look big, run towards them as though you're going to attack them so that they feel that they're going to be hunting down a predator in which they're going to have to do a lot of work and might be challenged.
Two very different strategies. They can't both be right, can they, Jason?
They're actually both right. And
oh, they are.
For two different situations. When you're encountering a bear or any wild animal for that matter, you want to give it a way out, a way to leave you alone, and you don't want to have it cornered. But the controversy around playing dead or fighting back when it comes to bears has to do with what kind of bear it is. If it's a female bear trying to protect her young, she sees you as a threat, and she wants that threat neutralized. And so with bears, you don't want to look them in the eye, but you want to back up. You want to give them escape routes. You don't want to be between the mom and the cub. And if she were to attack you, you do play dead.
Patrick's question was about grizzly bears. Are they different than black bears and other bears you might encounter?
They are. They can be more aggressive and more dangerous. Black bears are easier to scare away. But then the other situation where you don't play dead is if it is a male, either a black bear or a grizzly bear, when it's a male that's potentially looking at you as a food source, then you do want to look large. You want to wave your arms around. You want to yell, throw rocks, throw sticks, and be aggressive towards it. You want to scare it off so that it doesn't see you as a food source.
Okay, naive question. Can you tell by a glance whether it's a male or female bear?
Only if you're trained. So to your average hiker, it may not be that easy. So it's keeping an eye out if there's cubs around. If you see cubs, mom, then you would know it's a situation where you want to not be seen as a threat.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a lone bear without cubs, that's where I would, you know, act aggressive.
Joe's listening to us in Bellevue. He's got a basic question. He says, how do you know what to eat and how to get it if you don't have anything with you?
There's a few basic survival foods that everybody can learn to identify and recognize. Grasses are something that are edible at everywhere in the world. The green parts aren't very digestible, but you can chew on it, get the juices, and spit them out. And then the very base of the leaves, where it starts to turn to a root, is a corm that you can eat raw or cooked. Conifer trees, except for yew, use a poisonous conifer tree, but the rest of the pines and firs and spruces, the inner bark is edible. And that's a survival food. Even up in the mountains in the wintertime, there's nothing else to eat. You can pull off that outer bark and get to that nutrition inside there. Cattails are called the supermarket of the swamp. I think most folks can identify a cattail, and even in the wintertime, there's roots that you can get the starches out of and eat. And the last one is acorns. I think most folks know what an acorn from an oak tree is, and those can be – you can leach out the tannins, which are really bitter, and eat those, and that's a protein source. But
how do you do that? How do you leach them out?
You put them in a stream and let them sit for a few days, or you can boil them in a couple changes of water. Mm-hmm. So those are the four basic wild edibles, but beyond that, you know, you don't really want to mess with edibles unless you've worked with someone who's experienced, you know, you've taken a course and have the field guides and really know what you're getting into. Because there are a lot of poisonous lookalikes for a lot of different wild edibles.
What's kind of counterintuitive to people? What do they hear and it really surprises them because that's not what they would have thought it would take to be a survivor in the wilderness?
Yeah, I think some folks are surprised that food is such a low priority. You know, when we talk about our survival priorities, it's shelter, water, fire, and food.
In that order.
In that order. You know, most people who don't survive a survival situation perish because of hypothermia, and the second biggest killer is dehydration. So we want to address our needs for staying warm and out of the elements first, and then address our water needs. And we can go quite a few weeks without food.
You mentioned bring as much water as you're going to need, but also have maybe some backups if you're out there longer than you had expected to. What are the best ways of extracting water in the wilderness and making sure it's safe?
Well, you want to filter it through a good filter. And my favorite for a really compact way to bring in water filter is something called a survival straw. And it's basically just a large straw that has a filter built into it. So if you dig into a survival situation, you can just go up to a stream or a lake and suck the water through the straw, and it'll purify, you know, 20 to 50 gallons worth of water.
Jason Knight, co-founder of the Alderleaf Wilderness College. It's in Monroe, Washington. If you missed any of that, you'd like to go back and listen to it or recommend it to someone else, just go to KUOW.org and look for Knight, as in Knights of the Round Table, K-N-I-G-H-T, Jason Knight. David Hyde produces the conversation with Arwin Nix. Allie Ferguson gave us production help today. And Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.